Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Thanks, George. Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, on Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Mary Cranston, retired senior partner of the Pillsbury Law Firm and past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your moderator for today. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Erin Chemerinsky, the dean of the UC School of Law, I almost said Bolt, Berkeley okay. School of Law, and author of a new book, and I think an incredibly brilliant book, called We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century. Professor Chemerinsky became the 13th dean of the Berkeley School of Law in 2017. Prior to that, he was the founding dean and a distinguished professor of law with a joint appointment in political science at the University of California, Irvine. He previously taught at Duke and at the University of Southern California. Dean Chemerinsky's expertise encompasses con law, constitutional law, the federal courts, criminal procedure, and appellate litigation. National Jurist magazine has named him as the most influential person in legal education in the United States, and if you read this book, I think you'll agree. In his new book, Dean Chemerinsky points out that our republic's founding document starts with "We the People." But he goes on to say that the Constitution's promise of liberty and justice for all is being fought in our nation's courthouses by judges with lifetime appointments. With Congress in a gridlock, he says that both liberals and conservatives are realizing the opportunity that the judicial branch provides in settling some of the nation's most contentious issues, from gun control to reproductive health. Today, Dean Chemerinsky will discuss constitutional rights and the power of the Supreme Court to shape policies for decades to come and what that bodes for all of us. Please welcome Dean Erwin Chemerinsky.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I found the book so rich that I thought one of the most interesting things for our audience might be for you to just spend a little time pulling out some of the really significant findings and you know what you'd like this audience to take away.
Well, I want to start by thanking the Commonwealth Club for having me and for you for moderating tonight. I was very discouraged, as many people were, in November 2016 by the election of President Donald Trump. And I was especially discouraged by what it would mean for the future of the Supreme Court. I was hopeful that the election of Hillary Clinton would mean the confirmation of Chief Judge Merrick Garland. There would be five justices appointed by Democratic presidents on the Supreme Court for the first time since 1969. That didn't happen, and it meant then that it was President Trump who was going to fill Justice Scalia's seat. And as likely as turned out, there'd be other seats to fill as well. And as I was reflecting on this after the November 2016 election, it occurred to me that it's as, if not more important than ever, to put forth a progressive vision of the Constitution. Conservatives did such a good job, starting really with the Reagan administration, of developing their conservative vision of the Constitution. They developed a plan for how there would come to be a majority of conservative justices on the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts. I want liberals to do the same thing. And so what I want this book to do is put forward my progressive vision of the Constitution. And as you rightly point out, I start with the preamble, because the preamble really tells us the values the Constitution is meant to achieve. It's about providing democratic government. I don't think it's coincidental that it tells us that the Constitution is created by we the people. So many governments in the world, especially at that time, were monarchies or theocracies. Ours, from the beginning, was a democracy. The preamble tells us that it's meant to create an effective government. It's meant to establish justice. It's meant to secure liberty. And then there's one other value that's not mentioned in the preamble that should be there, and that's equality. Not surprising that the Constitution doesn't speak of equality. The Constitution institutionalized slavery. It was a document that was really meant to protect white male property owners. But the 14th Amendment adds equal protection. So what the book's about is taking these five values: democratic governance, effective governance, justice, liberty, and equality, and talking about how I think the Constitution should be interpreted to achieve them.
Thank you. One point you made in the book, which I think underlies a lot of this approach, is the notion that the conservative originalists believe that they have an articulation of the Constitution that is written sort of in concrete and immutable, and that the progressives are painted as interpreters of the Constitution that are trying to change things and go beyond what the original framers had to say about it. I found your analysis of this very enlightening, and it'd be great if you could talk to the audience about that.
Thank you. I've so often participated in debates with conservatives where they say, conservatives are discovering the true meaning of the Constitution, and liberals are just making it up. That's nonsense. The Constitution was intentionally written in very broad, open-ended language. What's due process of law? What's cruel and unusual punishment? Beyond that, it's hard to know what people were thinking about so long ago, and there wasn't a single intent behind any provision. So many were involved in drafting the Constitution and ratifying it. We would be inventing the intent. But beyond all of that, it would lead to absurd results if we tried to follow what people thought of in 1787 or even 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted. I'll give you a couple of examples. Article 2 of the Constitution refers to the president with the pronoun he. Well, there's no doubt that the framers of the Constitution intended that the president would be male. If you really want to be an originalist and you think the meaning of the Constitution can be changed only by amendment, it would be unconstitutional to elect a woman as president or vice president until the Constitution was amended. Or take desegregation of schools. The same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. If one really wanted to be an originalist, one would have to say that Brown versus Board of Education, which ordered the end of the Jim Crow laws with regard to schools, was wrongly decided. Any method of interpretation that makes Brown wrongly decided isn't one we should embrace.
Amen. In your book, you've got some very interesting examples of how the originalists have gotten pretty far out on a limb in their own views of interpreting the Constitution. Maybe you could give us a couple of examples. And I was thinking the guns and separation of church and state.
Well, what's so striking to me is how originalists abandon their philosophy when that suits their ideological ends. I'll give you an example. The same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment adopted a whole series of programs that today we would think of as affirmative action. There were things like the Freedmen's Bureau, very much meant to protect and provide benefits for the former slaves. So one would think that the conservatives on the Supreme Court, like Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, would say affirmative action is constitutional because it was intended by the framers. They, of course, were the most vehement opponents of affirmative action, abandoning their interpretive philosophy when it was inconsistent with the ideological results they wanted. Or the example you mentioned, the Second Amendment. The language of the Second Amendment is clear. It says, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Second Amendment tells us why there's a right to have arms for purpose of militia service. And in fact, from 1791, when the Second Amendment was ratified, until June 2008, every Supreme Court case about the Second Amendment said it's a right to have guns for militia service. But then, in June 2008, in District of Columbia versus Heller, Justice Scalia says that only the second part of the Second Amendment matters, that which says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. He said that's the operative language. The part about militia is just the prefatory language, doesn't matter. That's just reading out of the text what he doesn't want to be there. That's not really originalism.
Good point. You know, it's interesting. Scalia was, of course, probably the most originalist-based justice we've had. He, in fact, I think, said on several occasions that the 14th Amendment for equal protection would not apply to women. What's your view on that? Is there any risk that that would ever happen?
Justice Scalia said that explicitly. He said it on many occasions, that the 14th Amendment was never meant to protect women from discrimination. Of course, that would also mean it's not meant to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination, not meant to protect non-marital children from discrimination, and so on. To begin with, he's ignoring the text of the 14th Amendment. And all justices, liberal and conservative, would say you start with the text of the Constitution. The Equal Protection Clause says, no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. That protects all persons from arbitrary treatment by government. That would include women, gays and lesbians, and others. But beyond that, to me, that shows the absurdity of originalism. It's true that the framers in 1868, when they drafted the 14th Amendment, weren't concerned about protecting women. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't today have the Equal Protection Clause protect women, gays and lesbians, and others.
How do you think the originalists deal with the early precedent in the Supreme Court, like McCullough versus Maryland, which actually very directly rejected the concept of originalism? How do they get around that?
McCullough versus Maryland was a Supreme Court case in 1819. It's perhaps most famous now because of its role in the play Hamilton. One of the best scenes in Hamilton is a debate between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson in front of George Washington as to whether to create the Bank of the United States. And Thomas Jefferson's argument was, there's nothing in Article I of the Constitution about Congress's power that gives them the power to create a national bank. And Alexander Hamilton said, you can't read the Constitution in that way. You have to say that Congress has the authority to carry out its broad powers. Well, that was the issue in McCulloch versus Maryland, and the Supreme Court unanimously took Alexander Hamilton's position. Chief Justice John Marshall said, and I'm quoting, we must never forget that it's a constitution we're expounding, a constitution meant to be adapted and endure for ages to come. That was the Supreme Court in 1819 rejecting what today we call originalism.
You know, one thing I found fascinating in your book was your focus on the preamble, which does have these high-level concepts, and it's clearly the introduction. It says, we the people, this is what we're intending to do at the highest level. And then you said quite correctly that courts have kind of looked at that historically, or recently, 100 years or so, as sort of introductory fluff. And yet, it actually is a very powerful framework for everything else that goes on in the Constitution. And I was struck by that. Could you elaborate on that
Sure.
a little bit?
Early in American history, the Supreme Court invoked the preamble. McCulloch versus Maryland, that we're just talking about, the Supreme Court used the preamble. But at least since the early 1900s, the Supreme Court has said that the preamble plays no role in constitutional interpretation. And it's been decades since the Supreme Court ever mentioned the preamble. And I have an embarrassing confession for you. I'm teaching constitutional law for 39 years now. And until I began working on the book, I never talked about the preamble in class. I have a constitutional law casebook and a constitutional law treatise. Neither of them had anything about the preamble. The new editions do. But I just never focused on it. And I was trying to think about, where do we find the values in the Constitution? And if you read the preamble closely, they're stated there. And that's what we should be talking about. How do we achieve democratic governance? How do we create an effective government? What do we mean by justice and liberty and equality? And that's what I think constitutional interpretation should be achieving.
You know, it's such an obvious point, and it's very powerful when you start to think about it. Well, let's talk about some of those values, because there's some interesting materials in your book on those, too. With respect to democratic governance, you have a section on the Electoral College and how, in some ways, you believe it is actually unconstitutional. So I'd like you to talk about your views, but then also how you declare a part of the Constitution unconstitutional.
Let me start with that, and then I'll tell you why I think the Electoral College is unconstitutional. The Electoral College is provided for in the text of the Constitution. Amendments modify the text of the Constitution. So Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate commerce among the states. That would mean Congress could license newspapers as part of regulating commerce. But it would violate the First Amendment and freedom of the press for Congress to do that. The Constitution, in several places, protects the institution of slavery. But the 13th Amendment modifies that by prohibiting slavery. So if I could persuade you that equal protection in the Constitution, which is found in the amendments, is violated by the Electoral College, then something in the text has been changed by the amendment and can be declared unconstitutional. Now, there's two things about the Electoral College. One is, it seems to me inherently anti-democratic. We are the only country in the world where the candidate who loses the popular vote can become president of the United States. I know no way to reconcile the Electoral College with even the most simplistic definitions of democracy. It's also, one of the things I learned in doing the research for this book, an embarrassment, because the Electoral College was really created to protect slave states. Slave states were concerned that if there was popular election of the president, they would be at a disadvantage because their slaves wouldn't be able to vote. And so the Electoral College provided a solution for that. The Electoral College gives to each state the number of electors that's the sum of its representatives and its senators. Every state gets two senators. And for the House of Representatives, the slave states were credited for 3/5 of each slave present in giving them representation in the House of Representatives. And I found many quotes directly from the framers of the Constitution in 1787 that they created the Electoral College precisely so as to protect slave states. I think the Electoral College violates the most basic notions of equal protection. There's no reason why somebody in California's vote should matter a fraction of what somebody in Wyoming's vote does with regard to choosing the president. But there's a second level of argument. The problems the Electoral College are compounded by winner-take-all. 48 out of 50 states give the entirety of the electoral votes from that state to whoever won the popular vote. So if you voted for Donald Trump in California in 2016, your vote meant nothing because Hillary Clinton got 100% of the votes here. If you voted for Hillary Clinton in Texas, your vote meant nothing. Donald Trump got 100% of electoral votes. I think winner-take-all is unconstitutional. It is not provided for in the Constitution. It's provided for by state law. And those who are much more sophisticated with statistics than I am have shown that if winner-take-all were eliminated, it would tremendously decrease the possibility of having a president who lost the popular vote.
What do you think are the practical possibilities of the Electoral College being declared unconstitutional?
Zero.
Okay.
I think I have a good argument, but I don't think a court is going to do it. I think, though, that there is a practical possibility that winner-take-all could be declared unconstitutional. And there's a lawsuit that's been filed challenging winner-take-all. And I say it wouldn't make it impossible, but make it a whole lot less likely we could again choose a president who lost the popular vote. It's happened 5 times in American history, and twice just in this century.
Yeah. You know, there's an interesting question that came up out of the audience here. I'm just going to read it and get your take on it. I'm a lawyer, and at some level, I find it offensive that there should be a conservative or liberal interpretation of the Constitution. What do you think?
I'll go back to what I said in terms of the Constitution being written in a very broad, open-ended language. There's no way to interpret that language without it being a reflection of the person who's doing the interpretation. Let me give you an example. First case that I ever argued in the Supreme Court was a case called Lockyer versus Andrade. My client, Leandro Andrade, was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole for 50 years for stealing $153 worth of videotapes from Kmart stores in San Bernardino, California. He received that sentence under California's three strikes law, even though he'd never committed a violent crime, even though no one in the history of the United States had ever received a life sentence for shoplifting until California's three strikes law. The issue, is such a sentence cruel and unusual punishment? I lost 5-4. The five conservative justices saying that the states get to define what punishment to impose, the four liberal justices saying that's cruel and unusual punishment. I could go issue by issue through what now is before the Supreme Court or has been in recent years, and it's not surprising that the justices split like our society does on these issues along liberal and conservative lines.
Yeah. You know, another issue that comes out of the same milieu is this partisan gerrymandering. It's potentially going to be reviewed by the Supreme Court sometime in the near future. It is one of the issues you called out as of real concern in our democratic governance of this country. What do you think should be the solution to that?
Partisan gerrymandering is nothing new. It takes its name from a governor of Massachusetts early in American history, Elbridge Gerry. It's where the political party that controls the legislature draws election districts to maximize, say, seats for the party. What's changed, though, is because of sophisticated computer programs, it's possible to engage in partisan gerrymandering with far more precision than ever before. It's supposed to be that voters choose their elected officials, but partisan gerrymandering really means that elected officials are choosing their voters. There are two cases that the Supreme Court granted review in a week ago Friday, January 4th, that involve whether federal courts can hear challenges to partisan gerrymandering and whether it violates the Constitution. One of them comes from North Carolina. North Carolina is basically a purple state. It went for Obama in 2008, Romney in 2012, Trump in 2016, but always by a very small margin. Republicans got a slight majority of the votes cast for the state legislature, then drew state legislative districts to give themselves a supermajority of the seats in both houses. And the Republicans said they wanted to draw the maps for congressional districts in North Carolina to give Republicans 10 of 13 congressional seats. In 2016, Republicans and Democrats got almost exactly the same number of votes cast for the state legislature, but Republicans carried 10 of 13 congressional districts because of the way the election maps were drawn. I think independent districting commissions like California's solution to partisan gerrymandering, but at the very least, I think when there's a huge difference between the votes cast and the ultimate outcome, and it can be explained only on partisan grounds, that should be unconstitutional.
In the current configuration of the court with the retirements recently, what do you think the odds are that they will find that extreme partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional?
There are clearly four votes, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sinema, and Kagan, that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. Justice Kagan said so, joined by those other three justices in an opinion last spring in a case called Gill versus Whitford. The question is, without Justice Kennedy there, is there a possible fifth vote? We'll know by the end of June.
Exactly. Another point you make, and this is for your value of effective governance, is the notion of federalism and how the progressive view, particularly as informed by the notion of the preamble actually having some teeth, and that the role of the preamble is to ensure that our citizens all have basic protections and basic rights. And then there's this other concept in our Constitution about states' rights and how those have been used by progressives and conservatives to divide the world up in various ways. I thought you had some very good points about where we are today on that, and I just wondered if you could kind
sure.
of talk about it.
Throughout American history, states' rights has been used by conservatives to further conservative political ends. So in the early 19th century, those who opposed abolition of slavery didn't do so by defending slavery. They did so by proclaiming states' rights. The opposition to Reconstruction was in the name of states' rights. From the 1890s to the mid-1930s, a very conservative Supreme Court struck down progressive federal legislation in the name of states' rights. When Congress adopted the first child labor law, the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional as infringing states' rights. In the 1950s and the 1960s, those who favored segregation didn't do so by defending the morality of segregation, but very much invoked states' rights. What I think is interesting now is it may be progressives who pick up states' rights, and this would be the first time in American history. So the Trump administration said that state and local governments that don't cooperate with federal immigration officials will lose federal funding. The federal courts have said that violates states' rights. California is saying we should be able to have stricter environmental standards than federal EPA standards based on states' rights. So it's a really interesting switch, and we'll see whether the Supreme Court's receptive to it.
You've also were talking about separation of powers and how that it's obviously one of the main tools of our Constitution for checks and balances. How do you feel it's working out today?
Not well. Let me explain my concept of separation of powers and then explain the not well part of my answer. I think the genius of the Constitution is that it takes two branches of government to do anything important. So to pass a law, it takes Congress passing it, and the president signing it, or Congress in a vote to overrule the veto. To enforce the law, the executive has to bring a prosecution, the court has to convict. To confirm someone for the Supreme Court, well, you've got to have the president nominate, and then the Senate confirm. That's true of ambassadors and all cabinet officials as well. To go to war, I think the Constitution meant to have Congress declare war and then the president wage war. And if you think about it, it's a very elegant way of making sure that there's checks and balances. It is why I believe that President Trump does not have the authority in the name of an emergency to declare he's going to build the wall. The president can't spend money without congressional authorization. President Truman tried to claim an emergency as authority for taking an action not permitted by Congress. During the Korean War, President Truman seized the steel mills when there was a work stoppage. And the Supreme Court ruled against President Truman, saying, there's no exception in the Constitution for emergencies. In order to do something like seize steel mills, you need Congress to pass a statute, and it hasn't done so. To go to the not well part of my answer, I think the Constitution assumes good faith on the part of those who are going to govern us. I think when the Senate refused to consider, hold hearings, take a vote on Merrick Garland, they weren't showing the good faith assumed by the Constitution. I think for a president to say, if Congress doesn't fund the thing I most want, I'm going to shut down the entire government, is not good faith. Think about it. Constitution was adopted in 1787. So many presidents have had legislative programs blocked by Congress. But never before in all of American history have we had a shutdown as long as this one. To me, that shows that they're just not acting in good faith.
So if our Congress is dysfunctional and we have a president pushing the edge of the envelope on executive power, how do you feel the courts are functioning as a potential backstop for that? And what do you see in the next year or so happening?
I don't know. I would hope that if President Trump were to declare an emergency and spend money to build the wall without congressional approval, the Supreme Court would unanimously rule against him. When Richard Nixon claimed executive privilege to keep the Watergate tapes secret, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled against him, including three Nixon appointees ruling against him. Because I think that the court realizes that its duty, its fidelity has to be to the Constitution. But we'll see, and I think will tell us a great deal about the role of the court in enforcing the Constitution in the years ahead.
One of the questions that's come up from the audience has to do with our census and the questions that are going to be on the census and how that affects the allocation in Congress. What's your perspective on that, and what do you think is going to happen if that gets up in front of the Supreme Court?
Elected officials represent all of their constituents, citizens and non-citizens, adults and children, those who are documented and those who are undocumented. So in drawing election districts, it looks at total population. It doesn't look at just eligible voters. The concern is that by asking people whether or not they're lawfully in the United States, it will discourage people from filling out the census forms. And if they don't fill out the census forms, then that group of people will be underrepresented. It will skew how elections are drawn. There's actually a case before the Supreme Court related to this now. A lawsuit was brought to block this census question, and their desire to ask the cabinet secretary, why did you put that in the new census? And he said, I don't have to answer your question. And the issue before the Supreme Court in February is whether or not he has to answer the question as to why he put that inquiry in the census.
It'll be interesting. You also talk in your book about the value of liberty and the issue of privacy and how that relates to abortion and Roe versus Wade, which obviously is of great concern to many people. Where do you think we're heading on that with this particular court? What do you think is going to be the outcome over the next year or two?
I think there are five votes to either effectively or explicitly overrule Roe versus Wade. John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito have voted to uphold every restriction on abortion that's come before them since they became justices. You only have to read an opinion that Brett Kavanaugh wrote when he was a judge on the D.C. Circuit to know that he will join them with regard to it. It was about whether or not the government had to allow a teenage girl in detention to have access to abortion. And the court said yes over Brett Kavanaugh's dissent. And everything I know about Neil Gorsuch and what he said leads me to believe that he will join these justices. Now, since 2010, states have adopted over 400 different laws imposing restrictions on abortions in 33 different states. If the Supreme Court upholds these restrictions, it can effectively overrule Roe versus Wade, because it will close most of the facilities where abortions are performed. But I actually think there are likely five votes to overrule Roe versus Wade, and it's just a question of when.
So if your progressive view of the Constitution as guided by the preamble were the operative law, how would that affect Roe versus Wade?
The Constitution protects liberty. Liberty is really about autonomy, the right to make the most important decisions with regard to our lives. And certainly the choice of whether to bear or beget a child, whether to continue or to terminate a pregnancy, is a fundamental aspect of autonomy. The Supreme Court has protected many rights under the word liberty, even though they're not mentioned in the Constitution. The court said there's a right to marry, a right to procreate, a right to custody of one's children, the right to keep the family together, the right of parents to control the upbringing of their children, the right to purchase and use contraceptives, the right to engage in private, consensual, same-sex sexual activity, the right to refuse medical treatment. All of these are protected under liberty because they're basic to autonomy. The right of a woman to choose whether to continue or terminate the pregnancy, likewise, is a fundamental aspect of liberty. That's been the law since Roe versus Wade in 1973 and should continue to be the law.
In that same section of your book, you've talked about the Hobby Lobby case and that it was an extension in some ways of, went beyond where the Supreme Court had ever gone before in terms of essentially inflicting harm on others as a benefit of religious liberty, essentially. How do you react to that, and could you explain that to the audience?
I'm not sure if you remember Hobby Lobby, because it was several years ago. Part of the Affordable Care Act said that employers with more than a certain number of employees had to, as part of their health insurance plans, provide coverage for the types of contraceptives that are approved for women by the Food and Drug Administration. Hobby Lobby, which is a major company, it operates in 23 different states, it has over 20,000 employees, objected to having to provide contraceptive coverage for its women employees, and it said it was infringing its free exercise of religion. And the Supreme Court, 5-4, ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby. The justices were ideologically divided. Justice Alito wrote for the court. There are several things that were very troubling to me about this. One is Hobby Lobby is a corporation. I don't understand how a corporation can have a religion. Now, if the owners of Hobby Lobby wanted to, they could run their business without it being a corporation. But by being a corporation, they're creating a separate entity. There's a benefit to being a separate entity. If there's liability, the owners aren't liable. Only the separate entity is liable. But once they've created this fictional entity of a corporation, then I don't know how there can be religious beliefs. Beyond that, this is the first time in history that the Supreme Court ever held that a person can inflict an injury on somebody else in the name of his or her religion. Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, said there's the famous adage, your right to swing your arm ends at somebody else's nose. Well, Hobby Lobby shouldn't be able to inflict an injury on somebody else. It really doesn't infringe any right of Hobby Lobby's that nobody's forced to use contraceptives, nobody's prevented from using contraceptives. It's just giving employees a choice. And at the very least, making sure that women have affordable contraceptives should be regarded as a compelling government interest. The Supreme Court has said since 1965 in Griswold versus Connecticut that the right to purchase and use contraceptives is a fundamental constitutional right under the liberty of the Due Process Clause.
Another question that's come up from the audience is, does, in your view, the 14th Amendment protect the life of a fetus? How do you come out on that issue?
The answer is no. The word life in the 14th Amendment has never been interpreted to include the fetus in the moment of conception. What the court said in Roe versus Wade seems to be exactly right. There is no agreement in our society as to when human life or human personhood begins. Some believe that it begins at conception. Some believe that it's when the embryo takes on individualized characteristics. Some believe it's when the embryo implants in the uterine wall. At common law, it was thought that life begins at quickening, when the woman could feel the first movements of the fetus. In some religions, life begins at birth. It's not for the court to choose among these definitions. It's really left to each woman to decide whether or not she wants to continue or terminate her pregnancy.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
I had a couple questions here about the changing demographics, where most of the population in the United States, or a big chunk of the population of the United States, has gravitated to the coasts, and there are states in the middle that are losing population. What would you recommend in terms of potential changes to the Constitution or our governance structure that would allow the one-man, one-vote rule to be more effectively realized?
If practical reality wasn't the test, I would eliminate the Electoral College. If practical reality wasn't the test, I would eliminate every state having two senators, regardless of size. It makes no sense that California gets two senators, and North Dakota and South Dakota, that are separate states just by coincidence, get four senators total, or that Wyoming gets two senators and California gets two senators. Now, the problem is eliminating the Electoral College or changing the number of senators per state would require amending the Constitution. That requires approval of 3/4 of the states, and the small states will never go for that. So, can't do it, but if you ask me what I would do. In terms of the more realistic, one of the worst Supreme Court cases in recent years, though it didn't get a lot of media attention, was a case called Shelby County versus Holder.
Yeah.
It involved the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Section 5 of that law says, for those jurisdictions that have a history of race discrimination in voting, they can have a significant change in their election system only if they get pre-approval from the Attorney General of the United States. And this worked tremendously well from 1965 until 2013. In fact, Congress renewed it almost unanimously. The vote in the Senate was 98-0. There were only 33 no votes in the House. George W. Bush signed the renewal into law. And the Supreme Court, 5-4, declared what I just described for you as unconstitutional. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the conservative justice and said, "It violates the principle of equal state sovereignty that Congress has to treat every state the same. I challenge you to find me in the Constitution anything about Congress having to treat every state the same. There's no such thing in the Constitution." And if we know anything about the drafters of the 14th Amendment, they didn't believe that, because the same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment passed the Reconstruction Act that created military rule over the rebel states. And yet the conservative court struck down here an incredibly important law with regard to equality in voting. A more realistic change would be overturn Shelby County, put back into place the Voting Rights Act.
You know, there has been quite a bit of evidence since Shelby that probably was lifted early, given the problems that we've been seeing in voting patterns around the country. What do you think, realistically, from the court's perspective, we could get that overturned?
Not with this Supreme Court.
Yeah, and nothing with this Congress either, I take it. Yeah.
You know, Congress could try to adopt a new version of the Voting Rights Act. They would meet the court's objections in Shelby County. This Congress isn't going to do it. But it's more realistic than amending the Constitution.
If you could wave a magic wand, what would you recommend for the rules of voting in the United States to ensure one man, one vote?
Well, I think it's the things that we've talked about, but I would do other things. I think that we should have universal voter registration. We should make it much easier for everybody registered to vote. We should make it much easier for everybody to come out to vote. This is going to be heresy. I'd even consider what many countries have, mandatory voting. Australia, for example, has mandatory voting. Now, you can still turn in a blank ballot, but you at least have to go to the polling place. It's troubling to me that perhaps because of the obstacles to voting, undoubtedly because of apathy at times, we have such a small percentage of the electorate participating.
You've also talked about equality as not written into the original Constitution, but flowing from the 14th Amendment. Why do you think it wasn't in the original Constitution, and how do you see the strength of the underpinnings for equality in our Constitution today?
As I alluded to, it's important to remember that the Constitution institutionalized slavery. For instance, Article 4 of the Constitution had what we refer to as the Fugitive Slave Clause. It said if a slave escaped from a slave state to a free state, the slave had to return to his or her owner. Article 1 of the Constitution said that Congress couldn't ban the importation of slaves for 20 years. It was the only provision of the Constitution that couldn't be changed by amendment. Additionally, the framers of the Constitution really were protecting the rights of white male property owners. The notions of equality that we embrace today were foreign to those who wrote the Constitution in 1787. That's why equality, equal protection, aren't mentioned in the Constitution. But the 14th Amendment is perhaps the most important change in the Constitution since it was adopted in 1787. And it specifically says no state can deny any person equal protection of the laws. The Supreme Court has said that applies to the federal government as well.
One recommendation you had in the book was that, with respect to equality, is that you felt that our current state of the law in terms of proving discrimination on the basis of race or other prohibited classes was not the right standard, because it requires essentially intent as part of the elements. Could you explain that to the audience and give us your recommendation?
The Supreme Court has held since 1976 that in order to prove there's discrimination, it has to be shown that the government acted with the intent to discriminate. Let me give you an example. Washington, D.C. had a requirement that in order to be a police officer, an individual had to pass a test. Statistics showed that African Americans failed that test significantly more often than whites. Challenge was brought saying it denied equal protection. The Supreme Court says, no, unless you can prove that Washington adopted that with the intent of discriminating against African Americans, can't bring a race discrimination claim under the Constitution. Or there was another case, McCleskey versus Kemp, that involved the challenge to the death penalty in Georgia. In Georgia, like in most states, the evidence overwhelming that the death penalty is administered in a racially discriminatory fashion. Somebody who is African American or Latino is far more likely to be charged with a capital offense and much more likely to be sentenced to death by a jury. In fact, just last fall, the Washington State Supreme Court found the Washington State death penalty to violate the Washington Constitution on grounds that it's racially discriminatory. But the United States Supreme Court in McCleskey versus Kemp says it doesn't matter for equal protection that there's a discriminatory impact. Have to show that the Georgia legislature adopted it with the intent of discriminating, or that this particular jury acted with the intent to discriminate. Legislators rarely say that they're acting for racist reasons. Juries aren't going to say they're acting for racist reasons. It's very difficult to prove discriminatory intent. There are several federal civil rights statutes in the area of employment discrimination, housing discrimination, voting discrimination, that allow proof of violation by showing a racially discriminatory effect, racially discriminatory impact. I think the court should do the same thing under equal protection for the Constitution.
You also talked about affirmative action and the need for it. Obviously, there are some Supreme Court justices who disagree with that, along with many congressmen and senators. What is your rationale today for affirmative action, and how would you base it in the Constitution?
Here, I think the Supreme Court should, though it's not likely to, follow precedent. In 1978, in Regents University of California versus Bakke, in 2003, in Grutter versus Bollinger, in 2016, in Fisher versus University of Texas, Austin, the Supreme Court upheld affirmative action by college and universities. In each of the cases I mentioned, the Supreme Court's majority said that colleges and universities have a compelling interest in having a diverse student body. As I mentioned, you have been a professor for 39 years now. I've taught subjects like constitutional law and criminal procedure in racially diverse classrooms, but also in almost all white classrooms. When you talk about things like police stopping motorists for driving while black or brown, or affirmative action, it's a vastly different conversation if it's a racially diverse classroom. We're preparing students to have to deal with a very racially diverse world. And so the Supreme Court has said college universities can use race as one factor in admissions decisions to benefit minorities and enhance diversity. Now, that's not true in California, because in 1996, California voters passed an initiative, Proposition 209, that said that the government can't engage in affirmative action. There can't be affirmative action by state or local governments in California for education, contracting, employment. And the number of African-American Latino students at schools like Berkeley and UCLA tremendously plummeted as a result. So I just want the Supreme Court to adhere to the decisions that I mentioned. But I think now, with Justice Kennedy gone, now given the composition of the court, there's 5 votes to find all affirmative action unconstitutional. It's just going to be a question when the case gets to the Supreme Court that provides them the vehicle for doing this.
Do you think there's any chance that California will reverse that?
At this moment in time, California could repeal Proposition 209 and engage in affirmative action. There was an attempt to try to get something through the legislature a couple of years ago, but it didn't ultimately make it. I don't see any indication that California is moving to repeal Proposition 209. However, if the Supreme Court goes where I and I think everyone's predicting, it doesn't matter, because the Supreme Court would say all states are prohibited from affirmative action by the way they interpret the Constitution. What California struggled with Prop 209, is going to be what the whole country is going to have to deal with.
Ironically, that might be a time when the progressives are looking to assert states' rights.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
One of the questions from the audience is about Citizens United, whether the impact of that ruling on our separation of powers, our dysfunctional Congress and whether the court would or should re-examine the issue.
Citizens United was the Supreme Court's decision in January 2010, 9 years ago, that said that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money to get candidates they want elected or defeated. Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave a speech at the University of San Diego a few years ago, and she said that Citizens United will be regarded as one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in history. I think that's right. I think it has a tremendous distorting effect with regard to our election system, not with regard to presidential elections. Because the reality is, especially when you get to the November election, the Democrats and the Republicans can both raise huge amounts of money. I'm much more worried about the effect of Citizens United in the low visibility election, where you have candidates without name recognition, where who can spend the most money can make an enormous difference. And we're already seeing in many studies that Citizens United is having that effect. The candidate who's got the corporate wealth is much more likely to win. And of course, what we can never measure is who are the candidates who decide not to run because the corporate wealth is arrayed against them after Citizens United.
You know, I'm just thinking about the makeup of the current Supreme Court, and with Kennedy's retirement, there's a lot of talk about Roberts taking the centrist position. And I'm just wondering what you think is likely to happen and where Roberts will go.
John Roberts is and always has been very conservative. He's much more conservative than Anthony Kennedy. I think in some areas, John Roberts may moderate his views, being concerned about the legitimacy of the court and his legacy. But there's certain areas where John Roberts is a conservative true believer, and he's not going to moderate his views. Gay and lesbian rights, affirmative action, abortion that we've alluded to, fit into those categories. Let me talk about gay and lesbian rights. You might remember on June 26, 2015, in Obergefell versus Hodges, the Supreme Court said that state laws that prohibit same-sex marriage deny equal protection to gays and lesbians and violate the fundamental right to marry. I predicted publicly that the decision was going to be 6-3 with John Roberts joining the liberals and Justice Kennedy to strike down these laws. I said, John Roberts cares about his legacy. He wants to be on the right side of history. It's clear where history is going on this issue. I was wrong. Roberts dissents. He writes a mean, angry, vitriolic dissent. In fact, the only dissent John Roberts has ever read out loud from the bench since coming on the Supreme Court in 2005 was a dissent in Obergefell versus Hodges. John Roberts is a staunch opponent of any form of affirmative action. He wrote a case in 2007, Parents Involved in Community Schools for Seattle School District Number 1, in which he said that school districts could not use race as a factor in assigning students to schools so as to achieve desegregation and diversity. And he included his opinion by saying, the way to stop discriminating based on race, the government must always be colorblind. And John Roberts, I think, too, is a very strong opponent of abortion rights. So don't pin your hopes with regard to gay and lesbian rights or with regard to affirmative action or with regard to abortion on John Roberts, though there may be some other areas where he may move more towards the middle.
So if the Supreme Court goes, as you think it might, on those fundamental issues for various individuals in our society, what do you think the progressive opportunities would be using states' rights?
It varies. And the difference is, does the Supreme Court interpret the Constitution to prohibit states from doing something, or does the court interpret the Constitution to allow the states to do whatever they want? So take affirmative action. I think what the Supreme Court's going to do is say that affirmative action is unconstitutional. So states cannot choose to have affirmative action even if they want to. But I think what the court's going to do with regard to Roe versus Wade is say the Constitution says nothing about abortion. States can do whatever they want. But half the states will quickly have laws that prohibit all or almost all abortions. Half the states, or a bit less, like California, will have laws that still allow abortions, and it will be left to the states. What it then means is that it's going to be matter of money, that women who have money will be able to travel to states where abortion is legal. Before New York became the first state in the United States to legalize abortion, 1/4 of all the abortions in England were performed on American women. It wasn't poor women who were traveling to England for abortions. It's not going to be poor women who are going to be able to come to California. Also, there's going to be a real age dimension, that it's teenagers who don't have resources, who wait longer before dealing with an unwanted pregnancy, who are going to be victimized by states that prohibit all or almost all abortions. But that will be left to each state to decide.
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking back to my youth when abortion was fundamentally illegal in the United States, and all of the terrible stories of women in the back alleys, et cetera. Are you thinking that we may actually have two Americas, including going back to those dark days in part of the country? And what would that do ultimately, do you think?
There will be poor women and teenagers in states that prohibit abortion. They will again be left to the choice between an unwanted child and an unsafe, illegal abortion. That, I think, is unfortunately where the country is once more headed.
You have a chapter or two on justice, which I found really fascinating, and some of the issues that you raise with respect to policing, trials, and punishment. Could you talk a little bit about these issues and your views of where the court's gone?
Sure. We have an enormous problem in our society with regard to having police not complying with the Constitution. We hear of the high-profile instances of police shootings, but we don't hear about the day-to-day violations of people's rights by the police. And the Supreme Court has made it much harder to deal with those. Let me give you the case that I talk about in the book. It's a Supreme Court decision called City of Los Angeles versus Lyons. Adolph Lyons was a 24-year-old African-American man who was stopped by Los Angeles police officers for a burnt-out taillight. An officer lawfully ordered Lyons to get out of the car. He slammed Lyons' hands above his head under the roof of the vehicle. Lyons complained that the keys that he was holding were cutting into the skin of his palm. The officer administered a chokehold on Lyons and rendered him unconscious. Lyons awoke, spitting blood and dirt. He had urinated and defecated. The officer gave him a traffic citation and allowed him to go. Lyons did some research and discovered at that point 16 people in Los Angeles, most all like him, African-American men, had died from police use of the chokehold. Lyons sued the City of Los Angeles for an injunction to stop the police from using the chokehold, except where necessary to protect the officer's life or safety. The Supreme Court ruled against Lyons, saying he could not sue for an injunction. The court said he could not show that he personally was likely to be choked again by the police. The court said in order to sue for an injunction, you have to show you're likely personally to suffer the injury. There was a lower court case coming out of Chicago that involved some women who had been strip searched by police officers when stopped for routine traffic violations. They sued the Chicago Police Department for an injunction to stop police from strip searching women when they're stopped for routine traffic violations. The federal court said, we can't hear the case because the women can't show that they personally were likely stopped by the police and strip searched in the future. That makes it so difficult to have courts enforce the Constitution against police departments.
You also were talking about the punishment generally and some of the inequities there. What do you recommend?
There's tremendous inequities in how punishments are imposed in our society, starting with the death penalty. Study after study shows, as I mentioned to you earlier, that for the same crime, with the same prior criminal record, an African-American or Latino is much more likely to be sentenced to death than a white individual. I think that there should be courts saying, as the Washington State Supreme Court said, this is unacceptable. Who lives and who dies shouldn't be a matter of race. There's also other criminal statutes that were notorious for the tremendous disparity. It used to be that the difference between crack cocaine sentencing and powder cocaine sentencing was much as 100-1. But Congress has thankfully narrowed that, including a law that was just passed last month.
gotten a question here about the role of foreign powers in influencing the outcome of federal and possibly state elections. Are there constitutional issues that should be brought up as we think about this and we look at what's going on in the Congress to investigate and in the executive branch to investigate this problem?
Yes. The framers of the Constitution were deeply concerned about the possibility of foreign influence over their fledgling nation. As an example, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution has what's called the Emoluments Clause. I think most people until the Trump presidency thought emoluments were a form of skin cream. But this says that no one who holds a position of trust in the federal government can receive any presents or emoluments, benefits from a foreign government. This was meant to limit the influence of a foreign government over those who hold positions in the federal government. Donald Trump is violating the Emoluments Clause literally every day with the benefits that he gets from foreign governments. And we have to be concerned about foreign influence with regard to the American electoral process. Federal law, for example, prohibits foreign individuals or corporations from spending money with regard to federal elections. That's because we believe our elections to be decided by our electorate. Those are laws that need to be taken very seriously.
This may have to be our last question as we're kind of getting near the end here, but you have a very interesting discussion in the book, again, based on the preamble, thinking about whether the preamble does set up an entitlement to some fundamental rights of things like food and shelter, education. Now, this is not something that has generally, I think, been developed in the constitutional law, but it's a very intriguing concept, and I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit as our final question.
This is my chance to dream for the future. I didn't write this book with the thought that the Supreme Court next year is going to use it as a blueprint. I was writing the book to think, well, what should be the aspirations of a progressive interpretation of the Constitution? And I think that someday the Constitution should be interpreted to say that the right to life, the right to liberty, includes a right to education, right to food, right to shelter, right to medical care. Many constitutions in the world have these provisions. I have no doubt that the Warren Court was moving in the direction of this. It was ended by a decision of the Supreme Court in 1973 that, if you ask me what was one of the worst decisions of the Supreme Court, though not one popularly known, it was a case called San Antonio Board of Education versus Rodriguez. It was a challenge to the Texas system of funding public schools largely through local property taxes. The result was that poor areas had a tax at a very high rate, but still had little to spend on education. Wealthy areas could tax at a low rate and a great deal to spend on education. So in the same metropolitan area, there could be enormous disparities in what's spent in schools. And this, of course, continues today. I grew up in Chicago. The difference from, say, the Chicago public schools to the New Trier or the Glenbrook public schools. And this was true in San Antonio, where the case came from. And the Supreme Court, 5-4, found that the Texas system did not violate the Constitution. The four Nixon appointees to the Supreme Court, joined by Potter Stewart, an Eisenhower appointee, with a majority. And Justice Lewis Powell, writing for the court, said, there's no right to education in the Constitution. So disparities in school funding, no matter how great, don't violate the Constitution. Well, this closed the door on the idea of interpreting the Constitution to have minimum entitlements to education, to food, to shelter, to medical care. But I conclude the book, and I intentionally put it at the end of the book by saying that I think this should be part of the long-term progressive vision.
I found it very inspiring. I want to thank you. I really want to thank you for writing this incredible book, and I'd like to ask the audience to join me in thanking you so much.
And for our wonderful moderator.
Thank you. Thank you. As we've mentioned a couple of times, the book is entitled We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century. And Dean Jemarinski will be signing copies of the book outside of the room after the program, and we certainly invite you to get your copy signed. We also want to thank everyone here, as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Mary Cranston, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.